This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
Welcome to Friday. Welcome to 2024. I guess this is our first year in review show. It's just not much year so far to review. This is Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. What will you do as Seattle's newest city council member? Yeah, I'm talking to you. They're taking applications from the public. There's a vacancy because one council member is moving over to the King County Council. I haven't decided whether I'm running. I need to gauge my support. You have until Tuesday to send me campaign donations. Please don't include a return envelope on that. No, I'm not really soliciting money. We'll discuss that new council member, though, in just a moment. I'm going to get at what happened this week with a panel of excellent journalists. We've got political analyst and contributing columnist Joni Balter with us. Hi, Joni.
Hi, how are you?
Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
GeekWire contributing editor Mike Lewis. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you. We got Seattle Channel host and producer Brian Callen. And Brian, welcome.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Happy New Year to you all. Happy New Year to you watching on YouTube. So let's get at this city council of a very new set of legislators. Residents are going to presumably see some changes, a new way of doing things. And people even outside Seattle won't have the old city council to kick around anymore. So, Joni, what can our listeners expect from this crop of mostly newcomers?
A lot of different things. So definitely more peace, love, and understanding among the council members themselves, because so many of them agree on quite a few things. The work that will be done this month, specifically job one, and I know Brian pointed this out too, they have to fill the vacancy that you referred to and that you may be applying for. Mm-hmm. And also you're going to see a focus on basics. We could have done kind of one of those drinking games on the number of times the newcomers at their swearing in said, mentioned basics,
fundamentals.
Yeah. Potholes, yeah. Anti-graffiti.
Meat and potatoes.
Meat and potatoes. It just was
good governance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And good governance. That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was music to some people's ears. I thought it was a good thing. Mm. And the reason for that is that, you know, in the good old days, whenever those were, the Seattle City Council was really known for delivering basic services, the city that worked. This is, and not, sorry to say, or maybe not that sorry to say, not this sort of political activism, resolutions on national and international policy that didn't do a darn thing for folks who wanted their government to deliver public safety, help the homeless, and improve housing or any other sort of basic service.
Okay, you make it sound so simple. If they'll just focus on the stuff that matters, but how hard is that actually going to be?
I think it's going to be difficult for you. A few different reasons. I agree with you. This first month is all about figuring out a replacement for Councilmember Mosqueda, who is now on the King County Council. And so there's a lot of focus on that. That person will be seated by the 25th, we understand. So that's going to be happening by the end of the month. And that's going to be very quick, so a lot of focus on that. But there were four major goals that Councilmember Teresa Mosqueda, who's an incumbent, who's back now, laid out in the meeting on Tuesday and talking about this. And this was talking about the transportation plan, a huge deal because we've got the big Move Seattle levy coming up this fall that funds 30% of the Seattle Department of Transportation's budget. Yeah, we can do potholes, but some other constituencies are going to want something too. So that's going to be something where we'll see some differences, I think, emerge among the council members. We're also talking about the comprehensive plan. That's the plan that we have to redo basically every 10 years as a city. And this is something where Councilmember Morales actually has a lot of power here as the new land use chair. We're talking about where density goes, where housing goes, things of that nature. That's a big thing that has to be done by the end of this year. We're also talking about a big budget gap of $200 million plus. Where's that money going to come from? Councilmember Nelson says she's going to be cutting and looking for cuts. again, a lot of constituencies are going to be working after every dollar there. And then finally, and this one is probably, I think, one of the biggest hurdles to cross is this contract with the Seattle Police Officers Guild, SPOG. Councilmember Morales laid that out as a top priority, too. They haven't had a contract now in 3 years. And I think as much as the council is talking about law and order and things of this nature, they are going to have an interesting discussion on this one from a lot of different people in our community here who want to see some different measures of accountability from the police department, too. So I wanted to lay those out there because the council did that. I think they have a lot of work ahead of them. It's going to be slow to start, though.
I agree. I was interested in what new council president Sarah Nelson had to say, particularly when it relates to sort of her boys in the boat themed talk about all rowing and maybe moderates in the boat rowing in the same direction.
Right.
Moderates in the boat. Not as catchy.
At the box office.
I got to say, I'm probably walking past that theater.
Right. Right.
But her point about, she made two points that I thought were interesting and pretty unexplained. One about providing raises to cops. The weird thing about it is that even the union has not really been arguing about raises. It's been arguing about morale, almost exclusively about morale. And I don't know why, if they're giving you that idea, and that's what some of the council members are trying to do right now, right? They're trying to make it sound like we're going to work with you, we're going to get you a contract, all of that. But no one was really arguing about salary, and their salaries are not bad, nor outside the not misaligned. If you look at what people, I mean, the Seattle Times has done really terrific work on this. There are, what was there, 300 and something people in the department who are making better than 200K? I mean,
Those are higher ups, but as if morale
not
is
all
not
higher ups. Some of those, were people
to
actually
salary.
getting
some overtime.
Of those were overtime jobs
that's
as
true.
Well.
That's true. But what I'm hearing is there's going to be a big raise in that contract, and I think that has much to do with the fact that we only have something like 919 officers ready to go, deployable every day, and so they're doing all this stuff the city is to make it sort of easier to hire cops. They're letting folks take tests from a distance if they don't live in the area. But, when you get down to it, you really have to pay them to lure them to a city that has, the city council has been hostile.
So I'm just telling you, literally law enforcement people that I've talked to, and including the union president, who will always argue, your union president, Mike Solon, you're always going to argue for more money. That's part of your job. I understand that. But literally, he said, number one, morale. So if they're telling, and if they're telling you morale, why not address that in your rowing in the same direction speech to the council? Because there is something to be said for that. And in fact, when I've talked with law enforcement, I understand what you're saying about, let's throw even more money. Remember, the budget went up by, what was it, $100 million while we're losing officers.
Right.
So there's something there that if she was to cut funding, I'm not suggesting cutting it from law enforcement. I'm saying that something in the math isn't quite making sense to me right now to offer that as your first idea.
And I would agree, Joni, that I think they are going to get a pretty substantial
There's no question they're going to get one. Yeah.
It's going to happen. But I will say that just looking over this past year when the Seattle Police Department has really been trying to bring people in with extra dollars, hiring bonuses that are some...
How has it worked?
It hasn't worked that well.
Right.
And so that's where I look at this. And I think dollars are a part of it. And I think morale is too. How exactly do you improve morale? What do you think?
Well, I'll give you one suggestion. It has to do with how the newcomers on the city council speak about the police department. Because the previous group didn't speak favorably. And folks were like, well, I don't want to work for a city council that doesn't embrace the work I do.
That's true, though? What if morale goes down when cops are tear gassing and otherwise being abusive?
Yes, of course.
Do I want to be part of that organization?
But do not underestimate the impact that if you hear your bosses, essentially, the city council, bad-mouthing police, there's going to be fewer folks. At the swearing-in, very interesting, one of the new and very exciting members of the council, Joy Hollingsworth, was not afraid to embrace the East Precinct. Mm-hmm. She talked about the history, how the black community wanted the East Precinct. She knows that because she grew up in the Central District.
That's very true.
And it's got an interesting past to it. So I believe that all these things contribute, but I think that you cannot underestimate the way many officers felt when they were diminished by the folks who pay their salaries.
Which was my point. I felt like that is really what I can't speak for her, but that to me seemed like there was so much hammering on that particular point about how they felt the defund the police, how they felt about all of the language around it and the support that they got from council, that to come out and just say, and we're going to throw more money at it, when throwing more money at it has not actually moved the needle at all. Yeah. I mean, at all. So why not talk about these other things? If you want to throw, you're going to throw, I mean, it's a police contract. Of course they're going to get more money. Of course they're going to get all kinds of additional money for wearing body cams or whatever it else is that they're negotiating. They've been 3 years now out of a contract. They need a contract. I get all of that. It just was an odd way to frame the initial push that you were going to make as council president.
Yeah, and okay. I guess I would just want to make sure, and to your point earlier, Bill, I think that if the language of accountability is not included within this discussion about police, then we're missing out on something. I think it's important.
Yeah, maybe accountability, maybe not laughing at cases of
where pedestrians
officer
are run
fatalities,
over.
Yeah. Maybe lots of things. Let's talk also about money, because you mentioned a budget gap, $200 million. And yet I'm hearing some council members talk about wanting to lower taxes for businesses. Does that pencil out?
I don't see it. Mike, I know you had some thoughts on this, but I did read in Sarah Nelson's op-ed about this.
Yeah.
She is looking for cuts. I think that's a very important part of that. And I don't know exactly how you reckon that, but Mike, what'd you have?
So as probably the only person in this room who pays business taxes,
I pay them.
Pays them in downtown, Queen Anne, the lower Queen Anne, Seattle, uptown actually. So I understand this by the actual numbers. Everyone wants to pay less in taxes. I get it, and I'm not. And Seattle taxes are high. I get all of that. I do not think I only know one business really well. That's our tavern. I do not think that the amount of money you're paying in city fees and taxes, which can sometimes feel onerous, is in any way a game changer on what decisions I would make about my business. You're making decisions based on lease. You're making decisions based on supply chain. You're making decisions based on employees and employee pay rates. Those are like those are the load bearing pillars. The fact whether
I'm
or not,
drinking a beer there. What about me? What about your income?
Well, no,
who's going to pass those costs on to you? Of course.
So you're part of that supply chain.
Supply chain.
And I'm sorry, I meant to actually say Bill rather than supply chain.
One of the nicest supply chains you'd ever
exactly.
meet.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Well, I'm sorry.
No. But all I'm saying is that I don't know from a tinkering standpoint, from a city tax standpoint, unless they can provide an incentive that will get – she wants to get people back into downtown, businesses back into downtown. That's going to take employees being in downtown, and then you're going to move your business back there. It's also going to take more safety in downtown, and then you're going to move your business back there. I don't know that the city tinkering, unless the city can tinker with some way to make leases less expensive per square foot, it's going to be a very difficult road to hoe.
Well, with respect to that, I just think that even the rhetoric from the council president, but some action that says we will do something different from the previous council that sort of is supportive of small businesses. Come on back. We're here. We want to do what we can to help. And if they lower a tax, that's an action that people can relate to that say, they actually do want me to locate in any neighborhood in Seattle, but especially downtown.
But how much of that is a performative piece rather than something that's substantial for
the
business?
If you're a business owner, you're happy to hear it, but you're not going to move until there's actual numbers in place that actually pencil out for you.
Okay. We asked our listeners, what do you want from your city council, county council, wherever you are? Just some very quick hits. The most common refrains: homelessness, crime/safety/police, and environment. Mike says tax the large businesses and put it into building housing for the unhoused. Kaylee said full transparency and accountability in the homeless supportive services industry. Carrie says for the city of Seattle to become a small business supporter, as we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. Nicole says tree protection and recycling that works. Jim says focus on public safety and policing with adequate funding, as we were discussing. Three more. Nick says making the city safer for pedestrians. Daniel says take steps to aggressively address wealth inequality. in Seattle, and Alice says, seriously getting down to work to meet the city's climate goals. And we will discuss the climate here in just a moment. And if you want to be part of KOW's Community Feedback Club, text the word club. Here's the phone number. Here's the you're going to send the text to. 206-926-9955. That's 206-926-9955. Text the word club. And so as far as the council vacancy, any predictions? I mean, obviously, Shama Sawant's got to be the front runner.
Oh, boy. No.
Oh, yeah. She won't.
I don't
won't.
See that happening.
I don't know that you could call city council candidate Tanya Wu the front runner. That's one name we're all hearing, of course, yeah. I believe. That doesn't make her a front runner. And there's a little problem with her possible likely candidacy is that she was the opponent in the second district, city council district where I live, against Tammy Morales. And so would that create tension, or could we all grow up and accept her as a legitimate extra member?
And this would be a citywide seat, not a district.
This is a citywide seat, but you have to run for it again in the fall. So
that's right.
It's not for long.
And then if you wanted it again, you'd run for it again in 2025. And so I'm interested in this, and I think the Councilmember Morales had some interesting pushback on this. Can you read this as, I don't want to be in the same council with my opponent, perhaps? But I think she made the point that they're looking for someone with some legislative experience, because that is something this council does not have. Hmm. We saw the stats. This is something where this is the greatest amount of new council members joining the council here since 1911.
This is
before Bertha Knight Landis. May she rest in peace. But what I'm saying is
1926.
Yeah, they're looking for some sort of experience there to help guide along the process of what they do, which is legislation, and make it happen.
Tim Burgess.
Yeah.
Nick Licata.
I don't know.
Yes, Mike.
You know, actually, I wouldn't mind if somebody who used to serve on the council was said, I'm not going to rerun. I'm just going to fill this slot, get this group of newbies up to speed on how to actually manage policy in city. I think that wouldn't be necessarily a terrible idea. Mm-hmm. But I would say this. So when I was a reporter in California, and I had to cover the term endless when California moved to term limits, and it was obviously it went through that through the initiative and then through court process, but ultimately it was decided as legit. But one of the points that a really bright political scientist made about this, and it does relate to Seattle City Council, is when you get an influx of brand new people, the power structure shifts to lobbying, because that's where all the expertise is. And I'm not suggesting that they don't necessarily have staffers who know stuff, because obviously Sarah Nelson herself was a staff person. What I'm saying, though, is there's an absolute movement of knowledge to the lobbying class when you don't have people who've been doing it for a while. And that's the one thing that I think the city needs to be cognizant of. The new council members need to be cognizant of, because these are people who know more about policy than you do.
And in this case, there'll be a shift in power toward the mayor, who endorsed many
entirely.
Of these folks.
Yeah. Entirely.
And he is going to have, not only is he going to have a good time, but it's also showtime for him, because he cannot complain that the council members aren't doing what he wants, because they're going to do a lot of what he wants.
Yeah. Okay, I got to keep us on time. It's my New Year's resolution. Before we take a break, Seattle got a little more affordable this week. If you have a minimum wage job and you don't get your hours cut, the city's minimum wage for large employers, 500 workers or more, got its annual increase, and it rose from $18.69 an hour to $19.97 an hour. That's higher than any other major city in the U.S., yet not as high as Tukwila, $20.29 an hour. In the city of SeaTac, hospitality and transportation workers make $19.71. In February, Renton voters will decide whether to raise their minimum wage to $19 an hour. Mike, I think if Seattle is more expensive than those other places, how do they decide what's the right minimum wage?
Well, this is a tough one, right? I mean, if Renton, which is, I think if you look at all the various surveys of apartment costs, Renton is in the neighborhood of about $400 to $600 less expensive per one average one-bedroom apartment than Seattle is. Does that mean that Renton is actually moving its minimum wage into a place that people can more easily afford to live in Renton? Or does that mean, and that may be true, or does that mean it should be less than Seattle's? Or should it actually, does that mean that Seattle's actually should be a lot higher than the $19, because both cities have very different costs of living and yet will have at some point likely identical minimum wages.
Yeah. Well, this becomes sort of one city chasing the next. But
right,
remember,
exactly.
When our new laws, Seattle was the first city to go for the minimum wage in 2015, when our new law took place, there were built-in escalators. Mm-hmm. And so this was prescribed, you know, beforehand. And you don't know what other city is going to leapfrog. And so it's not that comparable. But I will say that three Washington cities that we've mentioned here, Tukwila, Seattle, and SeaTac, have the highest minimum wage in the country. And wow. So that tells you something. It's expensive here, but it doesn't explain. It's more the culture of the place and the beliefs in raising the minimum wage that explain why we're in that category.
Completely. And yeah. The cities that are going to actually probably be affected and have to move are the cities directly adjacent. When you can live in Kent, right, and then just decide, hey, I could get a job in Kent or I can get a job in Renton and make $4 more an hour, potentially, you're going to do it.
Right. And I know there have been a lot of different studies about what happened to Seattle when the minimum wage continued to go up.
Right.
And I don't – it didn't wreck the economy. I think that's pretty clear. I don't think
– Absolutely not.
Does it raise the cost of living, raise the cost of doing business, increase how much you can afford if your wage went up? Doesn't help you if you don't have a minimum wage job or your hours got cut.
That's true. And I think it basically what I saw out of this was something that – both sides of this argument kind of got some fodder on this whole thing in terms of what it did. I think the people who said raise that wage, people had more money in their pockets and they did not lose jobs. That was the whole point of it. And they said, hey, great work. It also happened in New Jersey. I know there's a study out there too. But then there was the other side of it, the actual hours or employment. There was some concern there that some of those hours may have been cut in some ways for some of these minimum wage earners. So I think there was a little bit of a concern there. But I guess I was looking at this too, this period we're talking about in between 2015 and 2020 was such a massive time of growth in the Seattle area that when you talk about what happened with the economy, did the minimum wage really have an impact on that? How much of a causal connection can we talk about when the rest of the city is growing so quickly? So I don't know exactly what to say about it post-pandemic here, but I'm really interested to see what happens with these other cities.
Yeah, so hard to say. That's an excellent point. Speaking of Washington State, as we were talking about statewide, because the statewide minimum wage in Washington also went up $16.28, higher than any other state, not higher than D.C., So one of the highest minimum wages, I guess second highest in the nation. And since I'm thinking of Washington State, that leads me to our next topic. After we take a break, our state legislature, mostly Democrats, but could some conservative initiatives roll back what lawmakers have done when we come back on Week in Review?
You rely on this podcast to stay informed and connected with your local community, and we rely on you. Without listener support, this show simply wouldn't exist. Be a part of the team that makes this show possible by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute. Donate at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thank you.
You are with KUOW's Week in Review. I'm your host, Bill Radke, with Seattle Channel's Brian Callanan, GeekWire's Mike Lewis, and political analyst Joni Balter, helping you figure out what happened this week. Our legislature got back into session. Yes, Joni?
Goes back on Monday.
Goes back on Monday. Both houses are majority Democrat. The governor's a Democrat. They've passed some progressive laws. But wait, we still have some conservative folks in this state, a lot of folks who just don't like to be taxed, particularly if it makes gasoline more expensive. A conservative group has turned in signatures for, the last I checked, 5 of its 6 initiatives. Do they get
six?
Are they all in now?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Each one would roll back some kind of progressive legislation. I mentioned gas prices because I think the initiative with the best chance of becoming law has to do with carbon pollution, climate change, and gasoline.
Yeah. Here's something that I don't know if anyone saw today I think it's Washington Policy Center, right? That what Washington Policy Center posted regarding the carbon tax.
They're a conservative think tank.
They posted Inslee's former chief policy person at a committee meeting about 10 years ago saying that gas prices would probably go up by 40 cents a gallon. If, in fact...
Not as Governor Inslee infamously said.
Pennies. No. I mean, like his own staff person said that in a hearing that was on well before this had enough popularity to move through. I'm not sure that the market and the content, like all the other variables, could have changed radically. I'm not suggesting that is necessarily proof that Inslee's wrong. What I'm more saying is that I think that if you don't think this is going to end up in a campaign against the carbon tax, 100% you're going to be seeing this for the next several months.
You know how sometimes you hear a public official say a quote, and you know that is going to hurt you forever.
You got a B plus on
Jenny
the snowstorm.
Jenny Durkin's Summer of Love, and Jay Inslee's Pennies, baby, pennies.
He might not win re-election.
You could not be more right.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a good day for me, actually.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, so I think we will all agree that will pass either some change will pass either the legislature or with voters next year.
And they won't go, whatever gets through, the legislature will almost certainly say no to and then pass it on to
voters. Or they might come up with something that says, hey, we got this problem solved. That's how initiatives for the
legislature. Or they can put out a competing measure too. That's another piece of it.
Right, yeah. That's how those
or
work.
Several.
Yeah,
but,
to confuse people. Yeah.
To confuse
but, you know,
yeah.
Even though gas prices are down $1.02 since the high in October, this one is a winner. This is going to win with the public. The problem for this topic is the planet happens to be burning at the same time.
Right.
But this is real, right in your face today. I'm willing to pay some of the highest gas prices in the country.
Yeah, I look at this and see the work that has been going on over the past several years to bring together what's called the Climate Commitment Act, the CCA. The government's been talking about it at the state level for a long time.
Maybe we should tell people what it is, because everybody doesn't know how Cap and Invest works. Can we just very briefly help the listener?
I can help with a little of it. Basically, the major polluters out there are required to put some money into a fund that goes towards helping our climate, and I hope that helps.
And the major polluters also, the micro polluters, which would be the rest of us. I mean, compared to them, all of our gas will also, bear some of that weight.
True.
But they pay for the right for allowances.
Yes.
They bid for allowances. And those allowances have been going for higher prices than expected and bringing in billions to the state government.
Yeah, the state has billions more in its projected budget here this year than they thought they would. That's a very good point here. I guess I just wanted to bring this up because it's interesting to me to watch how an initiative process that, over the course of months, maybe years here, is set to derail something that has been literally decades in the making. And this is something where you actually have. And I'm not quite sure how people are going to vote on this. I think it's going to be a very heated battle. But I do know in the past, voters have voted against carbon taxes in our state, most recently in 2018. And I'm just interested to see how this coalition of it was fuel companies, it was environmental groups, it was a lot of groups coming together to support this Climate Commitment Act. How much are they going to be there to protect it when this initiative comes around? I think it'll be a big test.
So somewhere, Tim Iman is feeling serious FOMO right now.
Sure.
This is absolute shades of Tim Iman.
Yeah.
He is just like, why was I not here first?
Using somebody else's money,
I'm here for you, listener. Tim Iman ran a lot of anti-tax initiatives.
All of them.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yes, pretty much all of them.
And there were none on last year's ballot, which I think was very telling. Tim Iman's out of the picture. Who else is coming in? This group, Let's Go Washington.
And then he also ran for governor in 2020, Tim Iman. And I'm also hearing that the sponsor of these initiatives, Brian Haywood, not soon, has designs on the governorship.
Oh, boy.
Oh, there you go.
Okay, having fun
this
now?
This is a wealthy businessman from Redmond.
Yes, mm-hmm. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Okay, so there's a lot we could say. I know that there are ideas in the legislature to modify this system, maybe allow... I don't know how complicated to get on this, right? There's questions about how many. I told you allowance prices are higher than expected. They could maybe change the timeline so that maybe we allow more emissions now, but we still maybe meet our goals later. Maybe we give some money to farmers, different groups that are mad about this. So, we don't know how this is going to go down.
Yeah,
but I would say in parallel, though, is the capital gains is an initiative to rescind the capital gains tax.
Yeah.
That is a strata of the population that is nowhere near as universal as everyone buys gas, right?
Yeah.
And all the trucking companies and the farmers and whatnot, I think this one is much less likely to succeed because I think the state was floored by how much money this raised. And it's raising it from, we can get into the specifics of it, but it's raising it from essentially very high income earners, which has always been sort of a sweet spot for the progressives in Washington State.
I think this measure is going to go down
I think so too.
Somewhere, either in the legislature or at the ballot. And the reason is, although there was a poll this week in Crosscut that showed that 57% of voters favor this. But
rolling back the capital gains tax.
Rolling back the capital gains tax, a Democratic priority. The thought is that the poll question did not mention sort of how it works, that it favors very wealthy people.
Right.
And I think that once that's explained, and that will be explained, this will not be a popular
favors
measure.
Wealthy people, meaning it's imposed on wealthy people.
Correct. Yes. Yeah, and I think maybe the fear behind it is like, oh, no, we're going to have an income tax. You know, I think a lot of people might have that knee-jerk reaction.
Argument.
And that is another measure of the six so far that this group is bringing out, saying, you know, we want to ban on any sort of state or local income taxes. You want to do that. They're talking about.
You think that passes? Not through the legislature.
It could. I mean, the legislature, I don't think, wants to touch that thing.
The voters.
But they've really tried to separate this idea of capital gains not as income, which is a big, big argument at the legal level there. And so we'll see what they do. There's that going on. There's this idea of trying to allow kids to opt out of sex ed, the parents' bill of rights, allowing police more leeway on vehicle pursuits. A lot of people were supportive of that in the polls. And then this
idea. What about that one?
I think a lot of people would support that. The Elway polls certainly seem to think that.
Allowing police to pursue more suspects.
Yeah, I think that that actually is a popular idea. And the reason is that what happens when they're not allowed is that nobody stops when they're supposed to stop for driving horribly. And we keep talking about highway and pedestrian deaths. And, you know, I don't think you want to hamstring your police that much, but they need to be more careful as well. There's arguments on both sides for this.
Yeah.
I think that the idea, it's sort of like everyone's talked about, or there's been many studies about this whole CSI effect and on juries, that they really see much more evidence as sort of sacrosanct than they did prior to sort of these ideas about, you know, television policing as opposed to real policing. I think police chases have this idea that we should be pursuing these people. And I think that there's a practical application to that as well. However, there is that massive cost when you're chasing somebody and putting a bunch of people in a potentially fatal situation for a vehicle. If it is a violent crime, I think they still have the leeway to go ahead and pursue. And they can right now. I think a little bit more clarity on when they should and shouldn't probably isn't in order. But I think this thing is going to sort of roll us back to a place that I don't know that we necessarily want to go.
And no one wants to vote on nuance, right, Mike? That's the big
challenge. That's why we have a legislature. I will remind you all, they're supposed
to
deal in nuance. And when you're running initiatives, the question to yourselves is, how much of this is going to get through to voters? Because it's in the weeds.
Yeah.
Oops. Weeds.
Yeah, right.
But
yeah,
maybe
weeds.
You and I, maybe all of us can sponsor an initiative to require nuance.
Oh, boy.
in political discourse.
There's a lot of nuance to that, too.
No. There's some real fine details about that. Okay, so legislative session, it begins next week, so we can talk about it next week. The governor's talked about mental health, homelessness, public safety, fentanyl addiction. We've got this issue of the state transportation plan costs ballooning, and what are we going to do about that? So more to come on those topics. Joni, I think, underlined the use of the word weed because we've got here in a new year, we got new state laws, including a gun buyer needing to pass a background check now and then wait 10 business days to get the gun and take a gun safety course within 5 years. We've got a law about hospitals having to form staffing committees to account for their nurse-to-patient ratio. We've got voters in Tacoma and Bellingham protecting renters in some ways. We've got tougher penalties for street racing. And coming to the weed now, coming to the bud of it, employers are no longer allowed to test for cannabis when they make hiring decisions.
Yeah. I thought this was a very interesting one because this is Senate Bill 5123, which passed in this last session here.
Thank you for the bill number.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
It's important to throw it out there because we're looking at this issue. And basically, you know, we as a state passed the legal use of recreational cannabis in 2012. And here we are 11 years later where employers are still using this test for non-psychoactive cannabis metabolites, which basically get in your system. They can stay there for weeks, and it's like, oh, this is in your system, and we can't hire you, when it's like, wait a minute, this is something that happened away from the job or whatever else. I know there's a lot of different discussion about this, but I think this is basically the state catching up to other states who have figured out a way to try to make sure that weed is not just legal. They don't get people don't get penalized for it if they use it off the job.
You know, I think this is really simple, and I've covered a lot of the marijuana stories for different outlets here. You know, unless you have a job that endangers other people, we're talking law enforcement, fire, airline work, or
and
something like that.
Those exemptions are
those
in
exemptions
place.
Are built in.
Federal employees too, because it's still federally illegal.
Exactly.
Yep.
You should not have to face drug testing. This invades your privacy. And I'll point out here that this issue wins both the right and the left. The right doesn't like government intrusion, and the left doesn't like corporate intrusion. So you can see why this is a popular.
And even the small group of libertarians.
Yeah.
They like it as well.
Well, the marijuana measure passed 56% in 2012.
Yeah.
Do employers think that their top performers are cannabis users or not cannabis users?
Oh, boy.
I think it depends on the employer, probably.
It depends on if they tested, and B, like you said.
Well, and I mean, I will. This does not prevent employers from testing workers if they have an accident with a vehicle that's used for work,
right.
Let's say.
Right.
Something along those lines. They can do those tests. It's something about that entry into the system there and saying, hey, there's evidence here that you used marijuana a week ago or something along those lines. That should not prevent people from getting employment is what they're trying to say with this.
Yeah. And do we know if the testing, because the testing used to be very rudimentary, like, That to your point exactly, like, can you tell if they were actually on marijuana then, or that they maybe smoked a joint 2 days earlier?
It is not great. I will say that the tests that they have, blood tests, are actually the best way to determine that. But there really isn't a bright line there either,
right,
Mike, because you look at this, and I remember this debate in 2012 when this was going on. A lot of medical users were saying, you know what? I would be, quote unquote, high all the time if you tested me right now, but I've been using this product for so long that it doesn't impair me, et cetera. So there's a lot of different ways to look at it. I just don't think there's a really good bright line test like we have with alcohol out there, and it makes it really difficult.
All right. Shall we pause and then come back and then whip through some stories that we have? We're not going to be able to discuss in full, but some other interesting things happened this week that you might react to. And maybe we'll make listeners jump through a turnstile in order to hear the rest of the show. We'll see about that. Yeah. Light Rail and more coming up on Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review this week means GeekWire's Mike Lewis and Seattle Channel's Brian Callanan, columnist Joni Balter. Hello on YouTube. If you're there, you can live stream the show. My name is Bill Radke. I host it. And so I'll give you a few things that we haven't had a chance to discuss yet, but some quick hits. Three people experiencing homelessness in Burien are suing the city for its ban on public camping. Burien prohibits people from sleeping or resting on public property overnight. It's a misdemeanor. This lawsuit says that's an unconstitutional ban, criminalizes homelessness, and says the city's granting police open discretion to arrest homeless people without clear guidelines. Burien's got more homeless people than shelter options, so we'll keep watching that one. Also, health officials say few people are getting vaccinated despite flu and COVID cases climbing. About 1 in 5 people in King County up to date on COVID boosters. 1 in 3 have a flu shot. I would think King County is more vaxxed than most other counties, except maybe San Juan. I don't know, but we're just not into it.
Did you get yours?
Oh, yeah.
Me too.
I'm all boosted up.
Me too.
I did
three
in 1 day.
Yeah?
I did the
two in 1 day.
I did flu, COVID, and the shingles
one.
Oh, no. The last one was not a bad idea.
I would not recommend
Do this. Not hug Mike to today.
Right. Yeah. This was a while ago,
but
I just recovered.
Yeah.
Okay.
Welcome.
Okay. That's good. Amazon's last standalone fresh pickup store closed, where you order groceries online, drive to the pickup spot. There was one by Starbucks headquarters, and they're out of that. They've still got the Amazon Fresh grocery stores. They're just getting out of physical stores. You know, they've got the Amazon Fresh and they got the Go convenience stores.
Got out of the clothing stores.
They got out of the clothing business.
Bookstore.
Bookstore.
Yep.
They like to change a lot. They're trying to
that whole fail fast
adopt
business.
A whole bunch of businesses and then they retreat.
Here's a business making a change. Starbucks is letting you use your own cup in the drive-thru and on mobile orders, not just in the store. They say it'll decrease waste. At the drive-thru, you tell the speaker you've got your own cup, you get a 10-cent discount.
So the key word in this is they said, please bring your clean cups.
Yeah.
Clean
yeah.
is the word. So I can just imagine, this reminds me of grocery bags that you bring your own, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What are they going to do when people send in, you know, not so clean? Are they going to sit there and wash it or reject it? How's that going to work?
For anyone who stays at a low level of anger about Starbucks drive-through lines, just getting around them, because they block streets, all of bus lanes, it doesn't matter, because people will not just park and walk in to a clear counter and order their coffee. They stay in their cars. Understood. This thing, adding that on, when people start handing them these cups that have been in their car for, I don't know, since the Clinton administration, and they're giving them, this thing that is the bane of my existence is going to get worse.
Yeah. I'm kind of excited because now I'll be able to pay $6.39 for my drink rather than $6.49. So I think that's a big step.
Okay, December was very warm in Seattle, 45.5 degrees daily average. Beating the old record was 45.3. Snowpack is low right now, record lows. And, you know, that matters, that holds that water. We are supposed to get, and we're expecting not much precipitation, not much snow this winter, although this week looks like we're going to get a dumping in the mountains.
Here's hoping. We need that.
Yeah. State Ferry is finally admitting it doesn't know when it's going to be full schedule. They don't have enough boats. The boats are going to take years. Some runs are just going to be down a boat for a long time. Staffing shortages, aging fleet.
So I took a look this morning at the Washington State Ferry's website and looked at ferry job listings.
Uh-huh.
I'd like a quick survey. How many job listings do you think that the ferry system has right now on its website, Bill?
20.
More than 100?
A lot.
Four jobs listed. So I contacted the Washington State Ferry System, and they gave me a fairly elaborate multi-tweet explanation as to why, from a recruitment standpoint, this is important. But it I'm not saying that they're wrong, and I'm not saying they're not giving me an honest answer. I'm saying that it didn't make a whole lot of sense. Essentially, it's we can't pull staff away from their jobs to train people because we don't have enough staff to train people.
Oh, right.
And it was this thing that you could...
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
And once I started getting dizzy, I realized I had to get down to the show, so I just put it aside. But nonetheless, they're right now, if you were to log in, four.
They're looking for a new head of the Washington State Ferry System because...
So Patty that would
Ripstello,
be five.
Right. Tack it up. Patty Ripstello says
she's
stepping
down. That's probably on a different
down.
Site,
I would guess, but I don't know.
Anyway.
Wow. Okay. Let's keep following that.
That up.
All right. Before we get to Fairgate, Brian, you pointed out, I think this is the Seattle Times story about Seattle could see its first conversion of a full office building into housing since the pandemic. And that's not easy to do that.
It's not. It's in the uptown neighborhood. So we're not talking about downtown proper here. But this is a several story office building that they're talking about converting into units. And I thought it was interesting for a lot of different reasons because, yes, it is expensive to do this. And it has to pencil out, as it does with every business. But this was the cost of this building was a certain cost before the pandemic. It's actually lowered since the pandemic. And so the time is right, I guess. And that was interesting to me about it.
It's super interesting. The problem in Seattle that we have right now is that it's very, very modern skyscrapers are not impossible, but nearly impossible to convert from and make financial sense.
And this
sense.
Is a smaller building. Right.
What we did during that giant boom was tear down all of the old office buildings. The way the plumbing and electrical is routed make it very easy to compartmentalize them. Look at the Smith Tower. Very compartmentalized building. Old buildings were like that. New ones are open. So they have the two. We've all done it. Every time you go on a new skyscraper, there's the two big sets of restrooms right in the center of the building near the elevator shaft. And then the offices tend to ring that.
Yeah.
That is actually a great structure for a skyscraper. Terrible for residential housing. You talk to the people who designed this, they say that the whole idea of massive conversion isn't going to happen. But if we could save these old buildings, they actually are laid out in a way that make them much, they're not easy, but they're much easier.
Right. Finding these naturally affordable pieces out there. Yeah.
Very interesting. Okay. I'm glad I brought up those little quick hits and then you learn so much, right? Okay. Let's go to Sound Transit considering building gates that you'd have to pass through with proof of payment before you could ride the light rail. These are different from turnstiles.
Well, they're blocks to people who don't pay. So
yeah,
there are clearly many cities in the country when this.
It's not a giant gate that's going to come up and down for every.
I think
individual.
We know what it looks
I think
like
it's lasers,
because
Bill.
It's
sure
going to be
lasers.
Cost dependent,
like a medieval castle,
right?
Great.
The portcullis.
So many cities who built light rail, they decided because it's cheaper to build not to have the turnstiles to have fare enforcement another way. And if you go back in time on this, that's when something like 95% of riders would pay the fare. Now it's about 55%, a little bit of give there because youth get to ride free. But before they do this, they're going to have to weigh the benefit, the cost. How much does it cost to put these in all the stations? And how much fare would they recover from that? That's going to be the calculation. And also, some people view the turnstiles as a sort of security component. So I think one more question to ask there is how many people are not riding Sound Transit who would come and pay fares.
Good point.
If it felt safer from turnstiles.
I think in Vancouver, BC, where they didn't, and then now they do.
Mm-hmm.
They said the stats there were that it got fewer incidents once they put a fare, an actual enforceable fare, but with a gate system in place.
Yeah, meaning someone who's likely to cause trouble is also wasn't going to pay.
Well, I guess that's the theory. That does appear to be the theory. But the idea is like so they're paying attention here. People aren't just boarding. They're boarding because they paid to go somewhere.
I think a lot more people are not paying, though, than these people who might be troublemakers, et cetera. And this is a big part of it. If you go back really ancient history, I guess 7 years or 8 years isn't that far. But when Sound Transit was approved by voters in 2016, there was an understanding that, okay, we're going to retrieve or recover a certain amount of money from the fare boxes to help pay for this system. And this is a big part of it. So the most recent report from 2022 showed that with Link Light Rail especially, that they basically brought in enough fares to cover 16% of their operating costs. They actually told voters, hey, we're going to get 40%, right?
Right.
So that's a big, big loss there. It's actually all across the board when it comes to their buses, when it comes to Link Light Rail, when it comes to Sounder here. But it's really most apparent with Link. And so I think they're trying to bring it up because this is what they said to voters. We're going to recover a certain amount from the fare boxes, and they're not doing it.
And it's going to give everyone a chance. Anyone who's ever spent any time in Paris and watched how adept people leap the metro gates.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they move it without even breaking stride. They just
slide
on
jumpers.
And I got to say that you get a chance for locals to work on their gate jumping capacity, because that's what's going to start happening.
Well, of course, they could just make it free if we would tax ourselves more.
As if we're not taxed enough for Sound Transit, are you kidding me? It's very expensive.
Yeah, well, if people aren't paying it, if part of the problem is that you feel that you need to have everybody obeying the rules, you know, you need to have like, I paid and you don't pay.
Right.
So there are a couple ways you could spend a lot of money trying to get people to pay, or you could tax everybody.
Who was it
make it free?
That was complaining about that they couldn't stand the idea of people paying $17 for a beer at a game.
Right. Peter Rogoff.
Peter Rogoff. That's who's saying that. And won't pay $2.50 to ride this.
And I guess to your point, Bill, there are a number of different transit agencies, not Sound Transit, but they are making transit free around the state of Washington. There's some places out on the Washington coast that are doing that. And so it's an interesting concept. But again, how much do we want to tax ourselves to make that happen? That's a very good point you make too, Joni.
Do you get the feeling that a place like New York City is so crowded, you are willing to pay for the subway because you need it to get around? You don't want a car. In the Puget Sound area, it still feels more like you're doing everyone a favor by taking transit. That's the same, like the attitude people.
It's a virtue
people,
thing.
People,
it's,
yeah.
It's
like,
in the virtue
don't make me pay on top of it.
But I do think that there's a component from Seattle's transportation master plan that is that there's not a big concern about bringing additional pain to drivers. I mean, that's the way you get people on mass transit. There's no two-way. San Francisco went through the same thing. Seattle is going through that right now. They've stopped requiring parking in apartment complexes to get more apartment. Yeah. I mean, this is not going to get easier. This is just going to get harder in this town from a car standpoint.
And there's more awareness of climate change, you know, the climate role, and people like, well, you want me off the road, right? Then there's the question of electric vehicles. That sort of plays. I'm curious whether we don't have enough electric vehicles to be affecting like gas prices or people's willingness to put up with higher gas prices, right?
Well, they're coming on, but they're coming on. They're a small percentage right now, so they're coming on slowly.
Yeah.
Okay, one more thing and then a smile, which is that the state government's giving out $40 million it got from chicken and tuna companies. These companies settled a lawsuit over price fixing. The state's only giving that money to people who make under a certain income, which some people object to because they say, well, all of us overpaid for chicken and tuna if we bought it. We're all scam victims. That's our money. We all deserve to get back no matter what our income is. Anyway, and then there's more questions about how this money's getting paid.
Yeah, so I have to tell you that there's a mini scandal around this because the checks went out and to these 400,000 people, low income, and folks were really complaining that Bob Ferguson's name was on the checks. It is on the checks as a printed thing. This is from, you know, the Attorney General's office, but this whole thing about it. Bob Ferguson signing it is kind of a fake scandal in my mind, really. Like, you know, he signs a letter explaining it, as does everybody else that's sending stimulus checks or any other kinds of these checks.
Wanted to explain it's not a scam.
They have to explain it's not a scam. So of the calls that come into the Attorney General's office since these checks have been sent, you know, people are asking, should I cash this? Is this real? Or is it okay if I do this?
I would also say, I mean, to the extent that Bob is running for governor and wants to take credit for, that's what you do as a political player.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
yeah,
the stimulus checks during the Trump administration were signed by, you know, Donald Trump. So I get it, or the tax rebates, I think it were. I get Ferguson wanting to claim he did put a letter, made sure it was prominent, and that letter was like, hey, here's who you thank for this. But I would also say that that's kind of what you do if you're in office. If the crime rate drops, is the mayor going to claim credit for this?
Right.
Of course. That's kind of what you do. I think the bigger problem with that was the database for who they – because a lot of these letters went to people who don't actually exist on this planet anymore.
But that's true of every time.
But I'm not excusing it at any time, Joni. I mean, like, literally every time –
1 minute of the show left.
You go with a bad database.
Yeah. Okay. Something to smile about. Joni, I know you just said two words.
Endorphin high.
Oh, I thought it was going to be go dogs.
Oh, okay, go dogs.
That works too.
And I wanted to add to that there's a Twitter account now called an X account called Mount St. Helens Wah. And it's
that one is wonderful.
It's not really the mountain tweeting. It's somebody calling themselves a mountain.
It's pretty funny.
It's been trolling Michigan fans. You know what's weak? A state with no volcanoes. Michigan's one of those states. And the Detroit Free Press replied, okay, now do Great Lakes, because they have Great
awesome.
Lakes and we don't. And the Mount St. Helens account replied, ask Spirit Lake how that turned out, which is the lake that got obliterated by volcanic ash from St. Helens.
It is. I've been following this one for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
It is really funny. Yeah. It makes fun of other mountains in other states as well.
Yes. Also some bad, dumb, juvenile, tasteless jokes in there.
That's
a given. Okay. I got time to just say goodbye and Happy New Year. And thank you to political analyst and contributing columnist Joni Balter, GeekWire contributing editor Mike Lewis, Seattle Channel host and producer Brian Callanan. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to see you. Great way to start the year. Thank you to producer Kevin Kniestedt, Bernard Ouellette running the board, and we got to go. I'm Bill Radke. We'll do this again. Week in Review next week.